This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 142, Always Practice Safe Docking. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Philip Gilfus. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a look back at All Good Things on the TNG finale's 20th anniversary, new and obscure starships coming from Eagle Moss, and big plans that are afoot over at Star Trek Phase 2. Then in the feature, we're joined by Tommy Kraft and Suzanne Abbott to discuss the Enterprise episode, Vox Sola. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Philip. Welcome back to The Ready Room. It's great to have you on co-hosting with me today. You know, I was watching your Twitter stream, and it looks like you've been doing another TNG rewatch.
I have, and I'm. It's going to be a very unique one because I'm now in season 6 of TNG. So I got started. See? So I had my nice cigar, started off season 6, but that means, of course, that I'll be rewatching DS9 now. So I was actually looking up the airing order, which is different than what I thought. So apparently I'm going to have to wait till after Chain of Command Part 2 to begin my DS9 watch. And then it's odd because then there's like 4 DS9 episodes in a row before you get to the next TNG episode. So it'll be interesting.
Oh, really? I don't remember that very well. I remember when DS9 premiered. I remember watching the premiere. And of course I was watching TNG every week at the time as well. But I forgot that there was a time gap there.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to starting Deep Space Nine, mixing it in, and going over there and seeing what's happening.
And you're going to do the thing where you're watching them in order that they aired, regardless of series. So you're going to be alternating back and forth. And then when you get into Voyager, you're going to be alternating with DS9.
Exactly.
Okay.
As Roddenberry intended.
Right. So you've been in the episode that some people think features Colonel Sanders.
Exactly. Yeah, it's but most people don't know he's actually Deep Throat from X-Files, and so he's actually okay. Yeah, there's a lot of secret information if you watch that episode that you get.
That makes more sense now. Well, let's go ahead and jump into the news, Philip. We are going to talk about TNG a little bit more today. We have three things that we'll talk about: the anniversary of All Good Things, also some really cool new ships coming in the Starships collection, and some news on Star Trek Phase 2 and what they have planned for later this year, some really big stuff. The first thing is really hard for me to believe, but Friday, May 23rd, so just 2 days ago as we're recording this show, marked the 20th anniversary of the airing of All Good Things. And I remember exactly where I was when it came on. I remember what I was doing when it was on the television. How about you? Do you remember that day?
I do, because I remember it aired, because there was a big lead up, like it was in the paper, which, you know, this is, you know, not pre-internet, but early internet. So, you know, there wasn't like a lot of things back then, but it was in all the papers, regular media, that TNG was ending. I mean, I think I still have it. My local newspaper had a thing in the life section, and I remember watching it. But what happened was they aired it, and then they aired it like 2 days later. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, both times I missed the beginning.
Oh, really?
So I like, yeah,
you're like,
so,
what the hell is going on here?
I think I can remember the exact line. You know, it's at the conference room. What happened after the welcoming ceremony? I introduced you to Worf, the other senior officers. That's how I watched it at the same time, both times. And so for the longest, probably like for months, I had never seen the beginning of All Good Things. But I remember it well because I recorded it on my VCR.
So. Yeah. And you were thinking, wow, the finale to TNG is just them sitting around in a staff meeting reminiscing about what they did on the show.
I was just waiting for the PowerPoint. So
yeah. And then Troy says, I know, Captain, I can't believe how I had my hair that day.
It was sure cold. Did we have the temperature down or something?
Well, it was, you know, for me still, with all the TV shows that I've watched over the years, I still don't think any series has had a finale that can top All Good Things in the way that it brought the series full circle by connecting with the opening episode, as well as just the impact of the story and how well put together that story was.
Yeah, and we talked about this on Earl Grey, our TNG podcast, but I think, you know, watching it, and even nowadays, it blows me away where they do go back in the past. You know, they bring back Yar, and they bring back everyone, well, for the most part, in their old uniforms, even though they messed up Data's, but forget about it. But anyway, but it's kind of cool, and then you get the future, and then, you know, because the great question out of every finale is like, well, what happens to the characters after this? Well, we show you, you know, this is what happened, and then we kind of, you know, play with it at the end. But, I mean, I can add nothing other than that it, of course, is a great finale to a great series, and was certainly better than what may have happened right after that. Which, I mean, I think that's the interesting thing. Looking at this news, people may or may not know that the writers of All Good Things were, of course, Ron Moore and Brennan Braga, who were the same writers for Star Trek Generations. And I know a lot of talk in the articles that we've looked at reminiscing about this 20 years is that they themselves are the first to admit, yeah, All Good Things came out better. We realize that. But yeah. But the dichotomy is they say, we like whipped out All Good Things writing that in like a month, and it took us a year to do Generations, and that, you know, may not have been as well as we have wanted. But I think the argument from them also is that All Good Things is a TNG episode, movie, whatever you want to call it.
Whereas Braga said it's pure, whereas Generations isn't, yeah.
It's more Kirk Picard dealing with a bunch of stuff.
Right. I think that another thing people may not know, especially if you're relatively new to Star Trek, is that they wrote All Good Things and Generations concurrently. So they were actually working on both these stories at the same time. And it became difficult to keep track of what's happening in which story as they're writing, because you've got these same two people writing these two stories at once. And I think writing both of these stories at the same time really started to take its toll on them, because they became very tired, and they talk about this, and they have talked about it over the years. Like Generations, for me, it's a good movie, but there are things about it that certainly could have been better, and it's definitely a mishmash. Of course, you've got original series and TNG elements mixed together, but even the transition, you know, the uniforms, the transition where, well, what are we going to use? Is it going to be the ones from TNG? Are they going to be the jumpsuits from DS9? We can't decide. Let's just kind of, whatever you want to wear today, throw it on. It'll be cool.
It was a casual Friday.
Yeah. So there's a lot of strangeness in there. Although, I have to tell you, I think Vulcans everywhere were really sulking after they saw that movie, because Guinan put them all to shame. No Vulcan has ever topped Guinan with the number of candles that she had lit at one time in her quarters.
Well, most people don't know, but when Guinan was on 19th century Earth, she went to the original Yankee Candle shop.
Oh, okay.
That was up north. Yes. And the original Yankee who did it. So he was actually a Connecticut Yankee that ran the shop, now that I remember.
This makes so much sense now.
And it's interesting, because there's a lot of times, even if you didn't watch it live, but those of us who did, you know, All Good Things, you watch that and you're like, oh man, and you kind of wallow at it, and then like, oh, you know, several months from now there's going to be a movie. But like you said, for them it was like, and not only for the writers but for the cast and the crew, it's like All Good Things and like next week we're filming, you know. And so there wasn't really a time for them to breathe, but as the audience, at least we got to have that bridge.
Well, it is amazing that it was like that. And it was like the focus was on the motion picture, that this was going to be, this is the next step for the franchise and for TNG. And yet All Good Things, which they pushed through, turned out to be one of the greatest episodes of television ever, of any show.
Yeah, and I was reading in one of the articles how that episode kind of almost helped, unfortunately almost, helped get Star Trek Next Generation some award nominations and even some awards, but it didn't quite happen, but it definitely came close. And there were some awards that All Good Things did get, but it kind of helped gain that legitimacy to sci-fi because in Star Trek and to everything else. And so it was certainly good. I think the funniest thing that I read with Brandon and Ronald was that, looking back, you know, the rush, doing all this together is like, you know, it was fun. We were in our 20s. We didn't care. It was fine. Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. Well, if you want to hear more from them, there are two great places to do that. There is an article on Yahoo TV, tv.yahoo.com, and we'll put a link in the show notes. But Yahoo reached out to Moore and Braga both. The writer there, Dave Nimitz, reached out to them to talk about this, and they shared. It's quite a lengthy article, very lengthy article, and they were pretty open about what went on at the time in the process. And it's interesting because they're talking about it now 20 years later, and they're looking back. And another place to go is to pick up Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Speaker Volume 2, which is called All Good Things, Words and Deeds. And this disc contains interviews that Larry did with Ron and Brandon both right at the time that it was being made. So it's really, really fresh. They're right there in the moment. And they echo a lot of what they told Yahoo. It's a lot of the same stuff. But it's interesting to read it 20 years after the fact and then also hear it from them right there on the spot as it's happening. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. But if you go over to Larry's website, LarryNemechek.com, and look in the left sidebar, I believe it is, you'll see a link that says something like, "Our second disc is out," something like that. And you can click that and pick it up from him there as well. Well, Philip, the next story is about the official Starships collection. And I just got my ship last week, the very first one in Japan. We're just now getting it. Issue number one. Of course, it's your baby, the 1701D. I just showed it to you on the other side of the room on the camera. Now, I understand that you have not picked it up yet, though.
No, I'm still waiting for Utopia Planitia to fill out my order, but they said they're working on it. But I mean, I think the Starship collection and you're showing me, I was telling you that, Amazon, I mean, I'm sure there's many other places, in fact, probably from the Starships collections website itself, but, I was like, looking at the price, I'm like, well, 31, 32, that's, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then once you showed me how it comes like with its own book, you know, like book, not like a small thing and this big case, I'm like, oh, I can definitely see why it's that much. It looks like it's definitely totally worth it.
Yeah, it is worth it, definitely. I mean, now it does add up. They release them every other week. So if you want to pick them all up as they come out, it's going to be like every 2 weeks you're going to be picking up. I think 30 maybe is someone reselling it, perhaps. I don't know. Because I think the price is around 20. I want to say it's like 24 for the US for each one when it comes out, something like that. The first one is cheaper, though. They have like a special pricing to kind of get you into it. So like the 1701D for me here in Japan was 500 yen. So basically $5. The next one ramps up to like 12, and then we get up to like $25 equivalent, I think, after that. But they're definitely worth it if you love the ships. And the story today is about some images that the Trek Collective has on their website and a video that Eagle Moss has put out. Now, as I said, we just got issue number one here in Japan. In the US, I believe you guys, what I heard, you're on issue 17.
Yeah, right now, I'm looking at the website right now.
And then in the UK, they're further along because they came out in the UK and Ireland first. The ships that they're showing us that are coming up are really exciting for me. Issue number 27, which I won't get here in Japan until, I don't know, like October, November of 2015, maybe. So I'm going to have to figure out how to build a time machine or something so I can get this. But it's the 22nd century Redux Romulan Bird of Prey that we see on Enterprise. And I absolutely love that ship. And the pictures of the Eagle Moss one from the Starships collection, it's just really beautiful.
Wow. And does it come with sort of an invisible minefield?
It does. It's in the box, but you don't know. Just be careful where you grab.
Okay. I hope you don't have any dinner plans with the captain when you open that up. But, I mean, I think the one thing I really like about the official Starships collection is it's both good and weird that the ships they're choosing. Because, for instance, you know, like you said, they started with the Enterprise-D. And then I think issue number 2 was the refit Constitution-class Enterprise.
That's right.
But it's like the classic Enterprise Constitution class is like way down in the back catalog of coming out. But then you'll have these other ships that, like, if you had asked me, like, what ships do you think they'll make? I would have never named these, but the fact that they are coming out is so awesome. Like, for instance, for you, Chris, the Bajoran Solar Sailor is issue number 18.
Which is an awesome ship.
So, I mean, they're definitely reaching into the catalog of ships here in Star Trek. So, if you have some ship that you secretly like that you're afraid of telling anyone about, it will be coming out, I assure you, on Star Trek official Starships at one point.
It will be, and that's what's so cool. So, the ships that are coming out, 27, I mentioned, is that Romulan Bird of Prey from the 22nd century. 28 is a Maquis Raider, which we saw both on Voyager and on DS9, and... But beyond that, they're doing the Zindi Insectoid ship, and they're doing the Krenom Time Ship from the Voyager episode Year of Hell.
Now, the thing about that one, if you pre-order it, and then right when it comes in, you can say, "Time's up," and then it'll be at your door. So
awesome. And if you don't like the design of it, you know, you can just change the timeline, and maybe it'll be a little bit different next time.
I see issue number 26 is the Tholian ship, so I assume there's more than one in the pack, and that, you know, you can create kind of a web with it, maybe.
I hope so. Or you just have to buy a bunch of them, you know, like they come in a six-pack.
That's how they get you.
That's how they get you. That's right. And the web is sold separately.
Oh, man. Well, maybe, you know, if folks listen to our episode feature, they can learn about a whole kind of other web to look
That's
forward
right.
to.
So this is really cool. And like you said, they are really digging deep, but that's what I love about this collection. And especially now that I have one and I can see how large it is, because I was originally thinking they were smaller, like micro machines, but they're actually like the size of my hand stretched out from my wrist to my fingertips. I love that you're getting ships that you can't get anywhere else because, you know, Hot Wheels has made some Enterprises and Diamond Select makes ships and QMX makes ships, which are really expensive, but beautiful. And here you're getting ships that are really nicely done. They're just the right size to collect and put around your desk or your room, or in my case, the studio here. And they're things that you're never, ever going to find anywhere else because no one else is going to make the Bajoran Solar Sailor from Explorers. Mm-hmm. Unless you can get Avery Brooks to come over and build it for you. You know, swing by Home Depot, pick up the pieces that he needs, and he'll come over and he'll build it for you in his off time.
And you'll get a lot of quality time with them. A lot of quality
That's
time.
That's right. So also on the Trek Collective, there is a video. Well, there are lots of photos, lots of great photos of the starships. And there's also a video where you can get a sneak peek at some other ships coming up in the collection. This is actually a video from Eagle Moss themselves, not a video that they've done at the Trek Collective themselves. So go check that out if you're interested. It's really nice stuff. Now, the last thing we have here in news today is about Star Trek Phase 2, which is the granddaddy of independent production Star Trek fan series. They've been around for 10 years now, which is amazing. They were the first series to bring Kirk and Spock back to the screen. And they have brought us a long list of episodes, which include Come What May, In Harm's Way, To Serve All My Days, which included Walter Koenig as a special guest star. Also, World Enough in Time with George Takei as a guest star. And also Blood and Fire, which was a two-part episode written by David Gerrold, who, of course, wrote The Trouble with Tribbles. The Child, which we did get on TNG, Philip, but this is the original Child, which was a script written for Phase 2 when it was going to be a new Star Trek series in the late 70s. There are several of those in TNG. In fact, Devil's Due is another one that was written for Phase 2 originally. There's also Enemy of Starfleet with special guest star Barbara Luna and Katamba. And they have three more episodes in the work, and they have a Kickstarter that they have launched to help raise money, not only to get these episodes out, these three new ones, but also to help flesh out this new 13,000 square foot facility that they have in upstate New York for shooting the episodes.
Yeah, and this is sort of, when you said the granddaddy, I like to think of it as the Flint of fan films. Just very old. But I remember watching these first ones, you know, with the, and certainly nothing but the Elvis Pompadour, James Kirk, you know, yeah. And but it was definitely, you know, I remember the early ones, and I might be getting this wrong, but Starship Exeter or Star Trek Exeter, whatever, was kind of after that. And it kind of was kind of these first steps into people trying to do fan films, and then kind of nothing for a while. And then you've had, of course, the past 2 years where it's just exploded. And, you know, as folks can listen, if they listen to Continuing Mission here on Trek FM. But I think, you know, phase two definitely took those first steps, and they're continuing too. I've seen that, you know, they kind of done some recasting here lately. And I think that'll definitely bring in some more interesting stories. You could see maybe the next one in the holiest thing, where a certain Kirk Marcus relationship may begin here.
Yeah,
that they show Kirk Marcus meeting Jim Kirk and how that may have started. And I do like how they're not afraid to tackle, you know, because a lot of fan films are doing something. JJ's doing his thing, that they're like, you know what, we're just going to do our thing, original series, you know, alternate universe, whatever you want to think about it. And so I think it's interesting how everyone kind of captures that spirit of the original series, each in their own way.
Yeah, definitely. And they really paved the way for everyone, because now when fan series come out, they're so polished that you're amazed. Like Star Trek Continues is so polished that you're amazed that this wasn't an episode from the 60s. It feels like so authentic. And same with Phase 2. But Phase 2, when they started 10 years ago, they were building all this stuff themselves for the first time. You know, when fan series come out now, it's been done, and people have, you know, figured out how to build the sets, how to do these things on a budget. A lot of these people who work together, you know, James Cawley does Phase 2. He created Phase 2 and he produces that. And then Alec Peters does Axanar. And of course, Alec and James are friends and they talk. And then Tommy, who's joining us in the feature today, is doing his Enterprise film, Star Trek Horizon. Of course, he's also working on Axanar. So it's a great community of people, of just very, very talented creatives, actors, professionals, designers who are putting these things together today. And Phase 2 was really paved the way for everyone. This new facility is amazing that they're doing. They're going to be rebuilding or creating the sets, all of the sets from TOS in one place for the very first time. So when they shoot, they're going to be able to actually just move to sickbay or move to the bridge or have the corridor or have engineering, which they haven't been able to do in the past. And to help fund that, as well as to get out the upcoming episodes, The Holiest Thing, which you just mentioned, Bread and Savagery, which is a sequel to Bread and Circuses, the original series episode, and Mind Sifter, they have a Kickstarter. And the Kickstarter, the goal was an extremely modest $10,000. And of course, that took a few hours. And they had that because they're very smart in the way they're approaching Kickstarter, which is, what's the minimum that we need to do the next thing that we need to do? And let's make that our goal. And then let's have stretch goals beyond that to get us to the next steps in production of the series. And if we hit those, it's wonderful. And if we don't, then we will move forward from there. But let's at least make sure that we're funded for what we really need. So the goal was 10,000. Well, they already have 581 backers as at the time that we're recording this. $37,546 have been donated, and they have 17 days to go. And the stretch goals are very, very clearly outlined for you. So you know, if they reach those, this is what they're going to be able to do next.
Yeah, and I think with each of these goals, you're definitely seeing what else can be done. You know, like I said, they've replaced, well, not replaced, but Brian Gross is now playing Captain Kirk. And so these episodes that they're trying to get funded are going to be, you know, under his new captainship, if you will. One of the things I like about this, that a lot of the fan series are doing, is being very upfront about where the money's going for, you know, explaining about, you know, the post-production work that's needed and how they're definitely still on a budget. You know, they're not just, you know, taking throwing all the money on the wall here. They're definitely being very dedicated on how they spend money. And so I think that definitely goes to the product they see. And I think phase two continues this tradition of if you put out a good product, the fans will come to you. And so I think if fans, you know, they have the course of a video that you can look at on their Kickstarter. But if you've enjoyed their past episodes, and I'm sure you can find them out there, this is definitely something that'll be worthwhile. You know, what you do is you sit down. First, you donate to Trek FM to make Trek FM possible. And then after that, you can decide which one of these film projects is worth pursuing. But Star Trek Phase 2, of course, is doing great work. And I think it's interesting that James is certainly, you know, it takes a big man to not be Captain Kirk after you've been Captain Kirk.
After you've been Captain Kirk, yeah.
Exactly. So the fact that he has that that ability to step down, he's the George Washington of Captain Kirk's. That he's still promoting it and seeing what works and what can they change to be better is definitely a sign of the product that they're putting out.
Definitely. And besides Brian playing Kirk here, I mentioned that a past episode that they did, the two-parter, Blood and Fire, was written by David Gerrold. Well, David Gerrold has actually come on board now as the showrunner for Phase 2. So that's one of the new additions and the changes in the cast and crew as well. Now, the stretch goals they have at $20,000, well, $10,000, as I mentioned, that gets the holiest thing produced and out to fans. The $20,000 stretch goal covers post-production for Bread and Savagery. $30,000 stretch goal helps them build these new sets in the new facility that they have. The $50,000 stretch goal goes towards Mindsifter production. And the $90,000 stretch goal goes for rent. Because even though they have this new facility and they're only using it at certain times of year to shoot, they have to pay rent on it every single month. And the rent is $2,500 per month. So that's an expense that they have to cover.
And I do want to clarify that the Mindsifter production is the name of the episode they want to produce. They are not actually producing a Mindsifter.
Right.
Though if they did, I guess then they'd be easier to get money from people. But
that's right. So Core, you're going to have to build it yourself. They're not going to do it for you. Have I mentioned our Mindsifter? So if you donate to Phase 2, the perks range from your name on the backers page and a digital download of the Juan Ortiz movie poster for The Holiest Thing, all the way to a walk-on cameo in an episode. And Phase 2 has done something special for us as well. Starting from the $55 level, there's a special Phase 2 Trek FM wallpaper that is included in the perks that you can get as well. So that was really nice of them to include us in this. And we're really pleased to help promote their project because we just love the independent productions. And as you mentioned, Philip, I do a show on the network here called Continuing Mission, which is all about independent productions and fan films. And in fact, I just recorded on Saturday, a new episode, which will be out by the time this Ready Room drops. And it was a big show. I was joined by Brian Gross, who plays Kirk, Brandon Stacey, who plays Spock, Rick Chambers, who wrote all three of the upcoming episodes, Dennis Hodson, who is the first assistant director, Robert Morrow, who is the gaffer and line producer, and Jamie Sanchez, who is a production assistant, and as you'll find out, is kind of the glue of Phase 2 that keeps everything running, helps Brian in the role of Kirk, and is just a general Trekspert. And they all joined me, and we talked about creating Phase 2, not really the genesis of it, but just the evolution of it over the past decade, as well as playing the roles of Kirk and Spock, and about the new facility and how that's going to really change the way that they produce their episodes, and all sorts of things. We really, really dug deep into Phase 2. So go check out that episode, which will already be out by the time this Ready Room comes out. And if you subscribe to the Trek FM Complete Master Feed, all you'll need to do from here is just scroll back a couple of shows and you'll find it right there in your feed.
Yeah. If we had had them on the Ready Room, we would have had done the Voyager Ready Room to fit all those people. Cause any other Ready Room would have just been too small for that big of a group.
That's true. Very, very true. We're definitely not going to put them in Archer's Ready Room.
No, they'd be bumping their heads and yeah.
All right, so we'll put a link in the show notes to the Kickstarter. And if you just go to Kickstarter and go to Kickstarter.com, and if you just type Star Trek into the search box, it'll appear right away as well, because there are just a couple of Star Trek ones up there right now. Most of the recent ones have been funded successfully. Horizon, Axanar, and the various ones that have been out there.
And I'm definitely waiting for someone to start that TNG fan film because, you know, look, my hairline, Picard was bald, shouldn't be a problem. That's all I'm saying. I'm available for a role.
That's what I was wondering, Philip, is, you know, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, it's going to be all next generation fan films that we're talking about.
And I'll be too old to enjoy it.
All right, well, that's all we have in news for today. Before we jump into the feature, where we're going to talk about the Enterprise episode Vox Sola, and we're joined by Tommy Kraft and Suzanne Abbott, we'd like to tell you more about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. As we tell you every week, Audible is the best source for audiobooks that you'll find anywhere online, and I really do mean that. They have over 150,000 titles waiting for you right now, and they add hundreds of new titles every single week. Audible is really... for those of you who love science fiction, they are just the champion of science fiction literature because over recent years, they've created their own label, essentially, and their own studio to record science fiction classics and create wonderful audiobook versions of these. Mostly books that, well, I say mostly, I think pretty much all are books that have never been in audio format before. And I'm a big fan of science fiction literature beyond Star Trek. And I'm so happy that they're doing this because so many of my favorite books, I've wanted to listen to them over the years, but I couldn't because they don't exist in audio format. So that's been a great thing. But beyond that, they also have a lot of Star Trek books as well. And every week we like to recommend a book to you. And so Philip, I asked you to choose something today. What did you pick?
I looked in the mirror, Chris, and it was dark. So I chose Star Trek: The Next Generation, Dark Mirror. I know, you know, being a Niner, Chris, you're very familiar with the Mirror universe, and our TOSers are as well. And of course, TNG, right? Never had a Mirror universe episode, but we did in the novels. And that's Star Trek: The Next Generation, The Dark Mirror, written by Diane Duane, who's a very famous Star Trek writer who's done many, many non-Star Trek stuff as well. But she wrote this, and this was before any of the Deep Space Nine Mirror Universe stuff and all that, and Enterprise as well. But this is it's a great book. It definitely tells about the Enterprise D being in the Mirror Universe, you know, encountering the ISS Enterprise D. It's narrated by a very famous voice, TV's Discord. And for those of you who aren't bronies, you may know him as Q. That's the other way you may know John DeLancey. You know, I don't know. So but yeah, John DeLancey doing a Picard imitation, talking, you know, these great characters. Beverly's the captain's woman. Wesley Crusher's trying to kill Picard and all this great stuff. So it's a definite recommend. And John DeLancey has that great voice, so...
Absolutely. John DeLancey, he narrates a lot of the Star Trek books and is always wonderful to listen to. Another thing about this book is that it's where we really get to learn about Cetacean Ops, which we talk about here on the Ready Room anytime we can, because we love the idea of whales and dolphins helping fly the Enterprise. And apart from the on-screen mention of Cetacean Ops, which is just a tiny little background PA announcement in yesterday's Enterprise, this is where you really get to find out about it. So kudos to Diane for, you know, helping us learn more about our aquatic friends who, I guess, wear Starfleet uniform wetsuits.
That's right. You know, it's the waterproof com badge. Not everyone gets those. So, you know, you have to be able to hit it with a flipper. So it's balance it on your nose.
We have talked about the flipper tapping a number of times here on the Ready Room. So this is a really great book. I used to have it on audio cassette back in the day when it came out. Listened to it in the car all the time, and now I do have the Audible version as well. And you can get it as well absolutely free, because as a Trek FM listener, we do have a special offer for you. If you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm, you can get a free audiobook of your choice and a 30-day trial to try out Audible and see how great it is. And if at the end you decide not to stick with Audible, you get to keep that book, so there's nothing to lose. But I know you're going to love Audible. If you love podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks. So check it out, audibletrial.com/trekafilm. Choose this or any book you want. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. Star Trek has presented us with more aliens than we can count, but most of these have been humanoid. Even the exceptions like Tholians and Excalibians and Species 8472 are still easy for us to imagine being real somewhere out there. In the first season Enterprise episode, Vox Sola, the writers and creative team attempted to give us, as Brandon Braga put it, a wildly alien alien. And today we're going to discuss this episode, and to help us do that, we're joined once again by Miss Suzanne Abbott. Hello, Suzanne.
Hello.
Welcome back, and also by Tommy Kraft. Hey, Tommy, welcome back.
Hello, thank you for having me here.
Great to have you back. So guys, it's Enterprise Week, and we had to decide which episode to do, and I had a few on my list that I've been wanting to do. One of them is Vox Sola. I threw it out there, and Tommy said, please, 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 can we do this episode? I love this episode.
That's a great episode. I think it's a classic episode of Star Trek that's like, this is what exploration in space might be like. And you're exploring, you know, these weird new life forms, encountering the unknown, and we're boldly going. I think it's a really good story.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of episode that really gets its tentacles in you, you know, and really makes you appreciate it.
Oh, tentacle.
It really does. So before we jump into the discussion, here's a quick rundown of the episode for those who haven't seen it or don't remember it. At the beginning of the episode, we see some aliens who we've never seen before leaving the ship, and apparently the crew has offended them by getting really raunchy in front of them by eating. So, I mean, shame on the crew for eating in front of these Cretaceans, but oh well. And then we find that there is some sort of life form that's been left behind on the ship, and it takes over the cargo bay, and it's so alien that at first the crew doesn't even have any idea what to make of it, or to realize that it's alive, or to think of it as dangerous. Then it essentially tries to eat the crew, and it holds Archer and Trip and some others hostage, and the crew has to figure out how to get them out of this web of plastic wrap, essentially, as we'll talk about as we go along. And then they finally get a clue. They take the creature back to its homeworld, and that's that. Sounds kind of like a boring story, doesn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit. I think on paper it does, but if you really think about its place within Star Trek and seeking out new life, and when you learn the behind-the-scenes production challenges for this episode, it takes on a whole new life, for me anyway. So, Tommy, let's just jump in with first thoughts on the episode. Tell us, what did you think of this episode the first time you saw it? And then how did you come, if you're like me, maybe you watched it the first time and you said, oh, that's an episode. And then you've come to love it over time.
Actually, when I came to love it when I first watched it, but not when it started. When it started, I thought it was just going to be another like monster of the week kind of episode. Mm-hmm. But at the end, when Hoshi finally starts communicating with the thing, it actually gave me goosebumps the first time I saw it. And sometimes it still does when I watch it. Because it's a really, I think it's a really great moment for Hoshi. And it also just gives you that moment that's like, these people are out there in the unknown doing what nobody else has done before. And they've found a way to communicate with this life form against all odds. And it's not just Hoshi, but she has the help of another alien, T'Pol, to figure out how to do it. That's why I liked it when I first saw it, because it had that really, I don't know, for me, it had that really unique feeling to it. Thought it was a great story.
I mean, I, this seems to me, which I mean, Enterprise isn't necessarily, you know, something I always have in the forefront of my mind, but I feel like this is one of, like, the Enterprise episodes. I mean, I'm not saying, like, the best, but I always feel like I always hear Vok Salah a lot when it comes to Enterprise. And so it was funny because when I first started watching it, I'm like, oh, is this the one where he has to apologize with the chainsaw? And I was like, oh, no, it's not this one. Because those aliens look like Cal Archer did in that other episode.
I love that episode, though.
Yeah. But
the chainsaw episode.
but yeah, it's very interesting. I think there's some odd points I enjoyed and will enjoy pointing out. But I think it was – I mean, to me, I think there's Enterprise episodes are a little bit better. But I'm very much a fan of the first and second seasons of Enterprise versus some of the others. And so I think this was definitely a good, you know, like you said, Chris, like, oh, that was an episode. But I thought it was like, oh, okay, good, you know, still first season episode.
For me, I really enjoyed it. It was kind of reminiscent of an original series episode for me. Just the way everybody was flying by the seat of their pants trying to figure out what the hell was going on. I mean, what did we do to tick these people off? What's this thing that's attacking crew members and, you know, holding them hostage? It was just sort of reminiscent of an original series episode for me. Just pretty cool.
Yeah, which is good because that's part of what they were trying to recapture with Enterprise. Mm-hmm. This episode, it's so close to the end of season one that I often think it's a season two episode. And like, I'll go and get my season two set out. And like, wait, where is it? Oh, yeah, it's episode 22 of season one. But that's an interesting point about it feeling like a TOS episode in the sense of what is happening to our crew members. It reminds me a little bit of the beginning of Devil in the Dark, where there's something happening to people, but we don't know yet what's going on. And there's this mystery. It also reminded me, and Philip, tell me if you got the same feeling as well, when they're in engineering, when Rostov and Kelly are talking about there's something weird going on and we need to go look for it. And then especially when Rostov goes into the cargo bay, it reminded me of First Contact.
First Contact. I knew you were going to say that. Yes, exactly the same.
Just the feeling of it was like First Contact.
Anytime you see the engineers you've never heard of in main engineering talking, you're like, not going to end up well for these guys.
Bad things are going to happen.
And you already hear the, ha, shh.
Of course, in Enterprise, they use the TOS color scheme. So engineering is red. And of course, here you've got some red shirts. We'll call them red stripes. Rostov was like one of the early red stripes in Enterprise. Poor guy.
Oh, yeah, poor guy. Though he did, I mean, you know, spoiler alert, he did live, though.
Yeah, so that's true. Well, that's the difference between being a red stripe and a red shirt. It's just a stripe, so you just get a flesh wound. You don't actually die.
It's just a flesh wound.
The spectrum of your color determines how much you'll get killed. So if you're wearing a full red shirt, does not look good.
So that's right. Although apparently if you have all three colors, you never die. Therefore, Wesley Crusher always survived, much to the chagrin of many TNG fans. They cancel each other out.
So you just need an ugly sweater and you're okay?
Well, there are three of them. It's like the Triforce in Zelda, I guess. They come together for great power.
I have a dumb question. Why does everybody hate Wesley Crusher so much? Like, it's I never easy. Had an issue with him.
Well, if you listen to the Earl Grey Wesley Crusher episode...
I think, Tommy, that it's just the idea that on the Federation flagship, with all these people who are the best in their job in Starfleet, that it takes this kid to save the day so many times in early episodes. And you feel like Geordi can't do it, Picard can't do it, Riker can't do it. Only Wesley can save the day. It just feels odd that would be the case on the Federation flagship.
In all fairness, you have a ship staffed with over 1,000 people, and it's always like the same 5 to 7 people saving the day every single time. I mean, you know, pick and choose your battles, I guess.
Well, I would argue, and I don't want to skip ahead, but I think there's a very unlikely hero in this episode that we'll talk about. And it's a certain young ensign who finds himself all alone on the bridge.
Oh, yes.
I agree with that totally.
Excellent. Well, that actually ties into the next topic here, which is to seek out and offend new life forms. Because even Picard had difficulty learning languages, for example. We heard him having to communicate and not offend people that they were trying to work out trade agreements with or make first contact with.
Shaka when the walls fell.
He had to wear a funny wig in Insurrection.
Insurrection.
Yes. So it had to be very, very difficult for these early explorers, for Archer and his crew, to encounter species for the first time and not offend them. And so naturally they do offend them. But I have to give them a pass in this episode because you would never think that simply eating in front of someone would be offensive. Now, maybe eating with your mouth open and smacking or, you know, eating soup with your hands or something would be offensive to someone, but not simply eating.
I think the problem, and I don't want to start off this episode, this feature section too risque, but, you know, they ask like, okay, well, you eat like you mate. And then the question is like, well, how do y'all eat? They're like, well, we eat with our mouth. Oh, so do I. Well, what's the difference? Well, you should do that alone. So the question is for that alien species, it's not how do you eat? It's how do you mate? What are you guys doing?
Are they doing it alone?
That is somehow like what we do. I don't want an actual answer.
And do they do that in public?
That's actually what I wondered when I first saw this. Honestly, maybe I have a dirty mind, but I was thinking, is there mating public like our eating is? I don't know.
I guess. So maybe if the crew had mated in front of them, everything would have been cool.
Oh.
It was too early for T'Pol and Trip.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was an interesting thing with the language here too, because Hoshi says that it's the same word for eat and mate, but it depends on where the emphasis is in the word. And it reminded me of misunderstandings and or words that aren't a word. So for example, I'm sure you guys know the word for grandmother in Russian, which Americans say is babushka, but actually it's babushka, so the stress is on the front. Babushka doesn't actually mean anything. And in Japanese, we have a lot of words that are written the same, but we also don't have stresses in syllables. But we do have vowels, which are separate syllables, and they're all pronounced. So if you don't speak Japanese, you would think it's just a stress like you would have in English. And that shifts the meaning of the word. And this reminded me of that as well. What Hoshi is dealing with here is a language that is harder to figure out because these words look the same to you, and if you stress it in the wrong place, then the meaning shifts drastically.
Yeah, and I think this kind of a situation, and I don't know, I'm interested in other people's thoughts, that this very situation is kind of what gives Enterprise maybe a hard time as a series as compared to the others. For instance, I'll obviously pick my own series du jour. Like TNG, you know, like most of the galaxy, not most, but a lot of galaxies known. I mean, we still deal with the unknowns, but we know a lot of stuff. But in Enterprise, everything's new, and they make mistakes, obviously, because they're the first ship to ever do this stuff. And so, you know, this episode where they've, you know, done something wrong, and it's a first contact situation, the shortest in the books. And so it kind of makes the Enterprise crew look, I mean, not like stupid, but, you know, like they're just making all these mistakes. But of course they should. You know, of course they should. But Right. Sometimes, I mean, maybe that kind of gives the Enterprise kind of a bad thing. Like, oh, well, this crew just, you know, they're not like Voyager and Deep Space Nine and TNG where they know what they're doing. But I'm like, well, that's the power of the series.
It's part of the point
of
the show.
Honestly, Voyager didn't know what they were doing. They were in the Delta Quadrant. They shouldn't have known. Unfortunately, they ended up knowing too much.
Well,
but Janeway did make a mistake once with the tac-tac, and she put her hands on her hips and pissed him off, and Neelix had to come in and save the day. But yeah.
Oh, you mean Voyager shouldn't have known what they were doing in terms of inner? Yeah. They should have offended more species than they did.
Should have.
Okay, I can get that.
Not been able to defeat every single ship when they're like a quarter the size of the Enterprise D.
Well, that was just Janeway's awesomeness.
Well, Janeway had the advantage, you know, if you offend someone, just buy them a coffee and everything will be good.
Yes, yes.
And because of Voyager's size, the Voyager itself could do a barrel roll.
That's true. And it does from time to time. We have seen that.
But I, talking about the aliens, and I think there was an interesting moment, and I don't know about y'all, and as we talk about the other topics, Travis was strangely assertive in this episode. Like, he was a problem solver. And then, like, comes that bizarre moment. And again, I hate to keep calling back to TNG, but, like, when they finally reach the aliens, they answer the hail. And, like, there's, like, two people on the bridge.
Yeah.
And Travis is, like, looking around, like, oh, it's me. Oh, it's me. I'm the only one here. Kind of reminds me of, like, first and second season TNG, where there's, like, zero people in main engineering. And people just have to go down to solve everything. But I'm like, Travis handles it pretty well. I mean, technically, he is a command officer. You know, he has that yellow or gold stripe. But it's a very informal talk. So I feel like, you know, he's like, oh, okay, I really do apologize. I'm sorry. You know, he asked the right questions. And then he's like, so where's the home planet for this thing we're finding? But then, like, I feel like he should have asked more questions. You know, it's like, okay, that's it. I'm like, how about a little more information about the strange alien we're facing?
The look on his face when he's apologizing is like, really? I have to apologize for eating? What?
Right.
Are you kidding me?
Tommy, have you ever had to apologize to anyone for eating in front of them?
I have not. But I have had to apologize for things that I didn't think I should apologize for, which might be a good substitute. I mean,
so did you buy Travis's apology here?
I think so, because I think he actually, once he realized, you know, that they found this offensive, even though he thought it might have been dumb, I think he realized that since they're another culture, they probably have wildly different standards than we do. And given his upbringing on a cargo ship, probably, you know, being around aliens a lot as a kid, it was probably easier for him to understand than maybe some other person who hadn't been around aliens as much.
Exactly. I think it made sense for him to be the one on the bridge, because that's a good point.
Yeah.
You know, he does talk early on in the series about all the places he has visited, and of all the people on the ship, except for T'Pol and Phlox, he is the one. He's the one human crew member who actually does have experience with a lot of different aliens.
Which would have been a great thing to play on, I think, in the show that they didn't, but more often.
Is Travis from space?
Right. I think he's mentioned it once or twice, I think. Okay. Yes.
Sorry, I just want to double check.
Yeah, that would have been a good thing for them to play on more often, through, especially at least through the second season before they head out to look for the Zindi weapon, where they really do start all encountering more aliens.
Right.
Well, let's talk about, this is something that I noticed this time. I hadn't really thought about it in the past. I've always thought of this episode as the focus of the episode being a really alien life form, and my focus has been on the plastic wrap creature itself. But as I'm watching it this time, I'm thinking that this is actually a Hoshi story, because she's the one character through the course of the episode who really has a through line, who grows. She grows in her confidence. She grows in her relationship with T'Pol, because at this point in the series, they really have bumped heads and they don't get along very well. And it pains Hoshi to ask T'Pol for help. And I think it kind of, I don't know if it pains T'Pol to help Hoshi or not. T'Pol's lines were interesting in that, I hold you to a higher standard because I believe you can achieve it, which is exactly what a lot of teachers do. I think we've all had teachers, I know I have in music before, who are really harsh on you, and you feel like they're just out to get you, but it's actually because they know that you can achieve something that another student can't, so they might actually go easier on a different student. So that was interesting, but I really started to see this as a Hoshi story.
I agree completely, and it's interesting that I hadn't really thought about it too much that way until recently, but she does have a lot to do, and I think it's some along the lines of some of those episodes where she had to kind of step out of her shell, where she was really nervous, that we had earlier in the season, like when she had to go to the ship where the people were all up on the hooks so they could get the chemical out of their body. She also gets to stand up for herself a little bit in terms of how she thinks the creature should be treated and such, and trying to make communication with it and treat it as an intelligent person or being, rather. And in that way, I think she comes out of her shell a bit more too, because she's talking to her fellow crewmates as somebody who actually has a voice.
Yeah, I thought a part of the Hoshi storyline, and hopefully, Suzanne, you'll can poke me here if I cross the line here about stereotypes, but like it's kind of a woman in the workplace kind of thing. You know, it's, you know, Hoshi and T'Pol are sort of the women of the bridge, you know, hey, you know, the, and I'm not trying to be flippant, but like the sisterhood, like, you know, hey, it's, you know, can we look out?
Sisterhood of the bridge.
Yeah. Can we look out? It, and they also change cat suits. I don't know. But anyway, but like, can we look out for each other or something? But like, you know, so where Hoshi's like, you know, you're always attacking. And I mean, you're always attacking me. You're always making me feel bad. And T'Pol's like, no, I'm actually, you know, with you and, you know, holding your higher standard. And Hoshi's like, oh, that changes everything.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of an interesting dynamic.
But a lot of times women in the workplace will be more catty with each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
She can say that. I can't.
And I will say it. Yes. And not even trying to help one another out. It's just trying to, I'm better than you type thing.
Yeah.
But with T'Pol, I really believe that she was trying to push Hoshi to better herself.
I think so too. And I don't know if this is unique between women. I think it's just how it manifests itself. So like if we feel this way about a colleague, I think we'll be more of just brush them off and just not talk to them and go about our own business instead of maybe going at each other.
Well, I think there was a certain passive aggressiveness with Hoshi. Like, I asked for your help, not for you to correct everything I did. So, you know, it's I think it's understandable because Hoshi, you know, there's an age difference, there's a rank difference, there's an experience difference. And so Hoshi being the young officer, you know, T'Pol's like, well, this, I mean, and T'Pol's like, you know, this is your responsibility, you know, this is, and Hoshi's like, I know, you don't have to remind me of it, I'm under so much stress. But you know, she kind of needs that reassurance, which of course she's not going to get from the Vulcan T'Pol.
Yeah.
But she at least gets the confidence, at least later in the episode,
and I think,
from T'Pol.
And I think a lot of that comes from her feeling responsible, even though she says, oh, so you think it's my fault. I think that Hoshi does think a bit that it is her fault that happened in the first place, offending the aliens, because it's her job to help the crew communicate with them, and also just being tired, like trying to figure out this language and not being able to, and just being mentally fatigued and therefore being snappier. You know, we're all like that. It's like, I have a rule personally. I don't respond to email in the morning. Like, I check my email in the morning. I don't respond to it because, like, mentally I'm not awake enough yet, and I may react to something in a way that I don't want to, and I otherwise wouldn't. So I wait till I'm in the right state of mind so that I don't say something to somebody that I don't really mean just because I'm really tired and exhausted, you know.
I can understand that. My coworkers know, do not speak to me before 10 a.m. or else it's just bad news. I will bite your head off.
So you employ the Janeway rule.
That's what I was just thinking.
Coffee
first.
I must
have my coffee.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a line that's used in the other storyline, which I actually think is a theme for Hoshi, when Archer slash Trip, you know, says, and Suzanne, that's not the other kind of slash.
Suzanne's going to go write a story
on
this.
Oh, shit. You mean edit it. I'm sure it's already written.
I have one started, where,
right.
Where he says the line, as soon as you give up, the game's lost.
Yeah.
But I think that applies to Hoshi, because she's very frustrated and, you know, I'm not going to get this and it's too hard and, you know, the UT is not working, blah, blah, blah. But like T'Pol basically says that more or less, you know, as soon as you give up, the game's lost. You know, we have confidence in you. The reason I'm so hard is because we have confidence in you. You are skilled. And so that kind of allows her to work with T'Pol and to get the solution here.
Definitely. While we're talking about that, because I don't really have it on the outline, but I do want to talk about the water polo match just a little bit. I'm watching it this time and I'm thinking that the scene goes on for too long, really. I mean, it's a nice character moment between Archer and Trip, but at some point you feel like they're spending a lot of time on this scene. But then they call back to it at the end in a way that I thought was very clever, because how do you demonstrate that the neural pathways of the crew, as they're being absorbed by this alien, are becoming intertwined? Because Phlox talks about how they're being absorbed and they're becoming one life form, and if they're not disconnected, there won't be six people in there anymore. There will be just this one alien. So how do you demonstrate that in a way that makes sense within the episode And the way they do it is by calling back to that scene and the fact that Tripp knows things about the rules of water polo that he shouldn't know because he's sharing a mind with Archer at this point.
At which point it became their attached episode. So we can go back to the slash.
Right.
Because that's all I thought. I was like, oh, they're in each other's heads. Oh my goodness, what's going to happen? No.
Yeah, but it's an, you know, if anyone wants to listen to the Hobbies episode of War 5, I would recommend it. This is sort of where we get a little into more Archer's fascination with water polo. But we also get, I mean, and if you want to focus on it, we have the bonding, the female bonding, if you will, though it takes a while, between T'Pol and Hoshi. But we get kind of the Tripp Archer male bonding moment, you know. Only Tripp knows how to cheer up the captain, yeah. You know, with a water polo tournament. So,
well, and they've been friends for a long time, since the NX program, and so it's natural that he would know how to pull Archer out of his funk.
And that whole beginning sequence kind of seemed very sitcom-y, of like Hoshi like talking on the bridge, and then like T'Pol's like, well, only if Tripp does his bad table manners, then like Tripp comes in and like,
and then the laugh track goes off.
Exactly. And like Tripp, like T'Pol's like his secretary or something. Tripp's like, how's his mood? I'm like, you find out yourself.
I didn't think about that. So, Tommy, did you also think that water polo was just a bunch of guys screwing around in a pool?
I got to be honest with you. Before Enterprise, I'd never heard of water polo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so when I saw that, I was like, I just everything they were talking about was completely foreign to me. So I didn't have an opinion on it one way or the other. I thought it looked kind of strange for a sport. But I'm not much of a sports guy anyway. So, yeah.
It's one of those sports that unless you live in an area where they do play it, you know, have university teams, right, and it's kind of a big thing, you mostly know it from the Summer Olympics, I think. In which case, I'm glad they chose water polo. And we didn't find out that Archer was into synchronized swimming and he was on the synchronized swimming team at Stanford or something.
That would have been interesting.
Do we have something against synchronized swimming? Or
no, I'm just trying to picture Captain Archer as... I'm picturing him on a synchronized swimming team.
Is that the thing, Suzanne? Are you picturing Archer in a swimsuit in the pool?
Yes, I am.
Right now? Okay.
No, I think that she is picturing him in the au naturel division of synchronized swimming.
Captain Fine.
Which is not an Olympic sport, but they are considering it as a demonstration sport for the Rio de Janeiro games coming up.
He gets my gold medal. But I also think it is a good male bonding moment because you literally get like, because again, I think one of the jobs of Enterprise was supposed to be it's closer to us than it is to, you know, TOS and Kirk, Spock, and Picard. And so you get the whole, you know, stereotypical men drinking beer and eating pretzels and watching sports and bonding. And, you know, I felt like there should be like a side hug or like a fist pound or something.
Chef should have delivered a pizza to them while they were watching. Knock on the door or the chime goes off and it's a pizza delivery.
With pepperoni and mushrooms.
That's not delivery. It's DiGiorno.
It's DiGiorno.
Stuffed crust. Because I love stuffed crust. The DiGiorno stuffed crust, it's really good.
Of course, order a vegetarian pizza for T'Pol.
Well, she wasn't there anyway, so...
Of course, T'Pol will not eat it with her hands. She will get a fork and knife and eat it.
Some people do actually do that, though, which I always find strange.
That's just wrong.
Yeah.
Well, it's the first season, so she would use a fork, you know, if it had been season 3 or 4,
well,
maybe.
It's a good thing we didn't invite Jon Stewart to be on the panel today. Otherwise, the rest of the show would be about his pizza pet peeves.
I remember that with Trump.
Oh, gosh. He did it again recently where he got into a battle with Chicago, the city of Chicago, over deep dish pizza. So. Anyway, then they made up, New York and Chicago made up. And they together attacked California for California-style pizza.
That's beautiful.
It's all about the apology.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the core of this episode, which is the unique alien. And the alien that takes over the cargo bay and nearly kills the crew members is probably the most unique alien that we've seen in Star Trek. Certainly on screen, not in comic books. And Phlox really sums up this whole episode for me when he says, "I'm not sure if you realize how alien this creature is." Because it is something that the crew cannot wrap their minds around, and I think as a viewer as well, it's really hard for us to wrap our minds around this. In fact, Rick Berman said it's very difficult to make a pile of goo the bad guy. And we'll also talk about production here a little bit, but Roxanne Dawson was the director on this episode, and of course she has so much experience in Star Trek, playing B'Elanna on Voyager, and directing as well. And she said that her first impulse was, how the hell are we going to do that? And try to figure it out. And it has to work. It has to be believable, or else the entire story just falls apart.
Did she like break the head writer's nose in frustration?
No, Roxanne is very sweet. She's not B'Elanna Torres.
She used her batleth.
Well, and again, not to keep doing callbacks, though I guess that's just going to be my job.
That's your thing. We're going to call you Mr. Callback from now on.
Exactly. A Matter of Honor, TNG episode. Basically, this episode reminds me, always practice safe docking, because you don't know what strange disease you'll get from another ship. And so that's what this episode reminded me of, because they in TNG, they dock with the Klingon ship, and they get a starship disease from that one.
Oh, too. Man. Now I can see Quark, a new business for Quark, selling docking ring condoms.
Before you dock with a ship, you have to ask a couple questions, standard.
Oh, man. All right, Tommy, what did you think about this alien? I'm especially curious what you think about it, because you're working on your film, Star Trek Horizon, which is an Enterprise film, and you've done other films too, and so you know what it's like to approach a challenge like this, a creative challenge. How do you make something work? What did you think about the alien here?
From a production standpoint, it was a freaking nightmare. I remember watching that behind the scenes thing, and I was thinking, maybe it's just because I'm used to having such a small crew, but how much of a pain it would be to shoot with that, and how frustrating it would be for the actors to have to hang around in that all day.
Yeah, like and 4 hours or more they were suspended. Scott yeah. and Connor both suspended from the ceiling in that web.
And plus, it wasn't just suspended, but they were all gooey and yeah. nasty, and it's like, ugh. But that said, it's the kind of thing I think as somebody who's producing it or is in it, when you see the final product, you're really happy you went through that for it, because yeah. it did work so well. They did a great job of giving that creature a personality, almost, without actually having a person play it.
Yeah.
It did feel very alive. And part of that was, I think, the Saran Wrap job that they did so well on. It felt like a living organism and like they were a part of it.
It really did. And they did some CGI for the tentacles, but otherwise that was all just plastic wrap and bubble wrap that was melted yeah. and then, like you said, goo put on it. And it did feel alive without any CGI, just the stuff suspended from the ceiling and attached to the floor.
Well, actually, I thought the stuff without the CGI tended to feel more alive than the stuff with the CGI.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Because, I mean, because I can't fault them for it, because they didn't have the technology even, 10 years ago that we have now to do it as good as they could have with the CG.
Yeah, I agree. I think the CG stuff was needed, though, just to show the threat.
Yeah.
The tentacles can come and grab you and all. But if they did it today, I think it would be more believable, especially the scene where Reed is closing the door to the cargo bay and he's dodging the tentacle coming at his face.
Yeah.
That didn't quite match up the way
he looks really scared, by the way. He looks really scared.
Well, wouldn't you be?
Well, he's a good actor. I would be freaking out.
An acting challenge.
He was scared because Roxanne probably told him that if you don't pull this off, I'm going to strap you up in that thing and hang you up there for 4 hours.
Yeah. So we go Klingon on him.
Yeah.
I do love it during the course of that storyline. And one thing I always find interesting about Enterprise is that they love to use communicators more than the ship's communication system.
Yeah.
To talk to each other. I'm like, you can just press the button. You don't have to.
They actually didn't do that very often, I don't think. I think it was only when they were, like, on the go, like, walking down a corridor or something, yeah. you know, and they weren't in a stationary position where they could actually just push a button and stand there and talk.
Well, remember on the original series, you know, Kirk would have to go down the hallway and then reach up and hit a button on the wall to call some. It's like, I need to call the bridge. Where is a communicator box? Oh, it's down the hall. Okay, hold on a second.
Bridge. Spock.
Spock here.
I'm on deck 5, near my quarters. I've been attacked by an Andorian.
They do that on Enterprise, too. It's just they had the forethought to put the communicator panels, like, everywhere on that set. It's like everywhere they go, there's one on the wall somewhere they can push a button.
And at a reachable height, also.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like in every 5-foot mark, there's one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that would actually make sense from a design standpoint if you were designing a starship where you wanted an intercom system like that.
Philip is picturing them on the bridge where they, like, pull out the communicator and talk to each other station to station.
It's like the walkie-talkies of the 1980s when you were, like, 6 years old.
Hoshi gets irritated. Malcolm, I'm right here. I'm right across from you. You don't need to use the communicator.
It's like Facebooking in the same room.
It's poking. It's 22nd century poking.
Yeah, right. Turns out that's like the best, the most popular app for the communicator is the Poke app.
Yes.
Well, it kind of reminds me in Voyager when Kim and Tuvok talk to each other on their comm badges to each other's station, like, Ensign Kim, I don't think you should do that. Well, Tuvok, you're a pootie head. You know, it just fell apart.
That's Kim's passive aggressiveness, right? I'm like, I'm not going to talk to Tuvok face to face. I'll talk to him over my comm badge.
Serves you right.
If you haven't seen it on the Enterprise Season 1 Blu-ray set, there's a documentary called On the Set. And this thing was shot back at the time they were producing this episode. And for some reason, it never aired. I don't know why it never aired. I don't know what it was actually produced for. It feels like an Entertainment Weekly type thing, but it wasn't produced by Entertainment Weekly. But it's an On the Set of Enterprise, and specifically this episode, and they follow the entire development from the story concept to how they made the decisions on how to create the alien and how they met the creative challenges. And Roxanne Dawson talks extensively about the choices, and you get to actually see the writer's room, for one thing, and you get to see Brannon do some very weird positions as he demonstrates the cover of an H.P. Lovecraft book that he had seen, which was the inspiration for the alien in this episode, and having people suspended in it and such. And he's describing it. He didn't have a copy with him at the time, so he's describing it to the other writers, and it's pretty funny. But you also get to see the meeting of the creative staff with Roxanne as they plan out how to do the alien. You get to see them melting plastic wrap and bubble wrap and twisting it to make it look organic, which has to be a huge challenge. And how even when something was maybe it needed to be trimmed on the set, and someone cut it, and Roxanne's like, no, cut, we can't do this. It can't look cut. If it looks cut, it doesn't look organic. And then she says, you know, what do you do in that situation? Do you stop everything when you're trying to shoot this entire episode in 7 days? Or do you just let it go and hope no one else notices? And I know as a creative myself, I'm like her. I would stop everything and I would spend like 6 hours on this little detail that probably 99% of the people seeing my work won't even notice, but it matters to me. So that was an interesting challenge. And you get to see that the jackets that they had were covered in the plastic wrap as well, with zippers on the back so that the actors could slide into them. And then they put flight harnesses on them and flying harnesses and hoist them up and then hang them there for like 4 hours, paint their faces with goo. It had to be the most miserable thing ever.
Yeah, I mean,
the whole goo thing is just... Ugh.
Well, it's funny you said, how do you make a goo scary? Wasn't that the last 2 seasons of Deep Space Nine? I mean, you know, this is sort of the pre-founders.
Except that they were able to take humanoid form. Right. Yeah, if there were just buckets of goo around starships, if, you know, there was a bucket of goo in the park in San Francisco or something, no one's going to be too scared about that.
But, like, the alien homeworld did kind of give me that founder homeworld vibe of one great link, one great consciousness.
What was the lighting? It was like the Japanese lamps out there alongside the Great Link that really made it work and made it, you know, feel kind of eerie.
Yeah, and I like that the alien had to give specific coordinates, because apparently that was the only landing spot on the entire planet. I think they could have found that by themselves. Well, without
isn't he taking up the whole planet?
Yeah, the whole planet is covered. It's covered by this creature, except for that one spot.
So they could have just chucked it anywhere, really.
Well, you would think so, right? After you see the alien reabsorb the missing part, like just chuck it anywhere. But, you know, I mean, it's think about your house where you live. You know, you can't just suddenly decide to move in next door to somebody else out of the blue. The people that already live there would be kind of pissed.
Well, it reminds me of that game, and I'm completely blanking on what it is, where you use the magnets to, like, give the guy, like, a goatee or a beard or an eyebrow.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
So, like, yeah.
I loved that game.
If you put that in the wrong place, it's like giving him, like, a random sideburn. You have to put it in the right place.
Or unibrow.
Exactly.
Tommy, what did you think about the solutions that they show us in that behind-the-scenes documentary?
Oh, I thought it was very cool from a production standpoint. And you mentioned, as a creative type, wanting to get things perfect. And as a director myself, I know exactly how that goes, where you have that situation where you have to either make a decision based on time or your quote-unquote artistic integrity. And it's, I think Roxanne handled that very well, and I say Roxanne because I'm on a first name basis with her. But it's especially that episode. I was glad they had those features because it was really cool to see how they went about doing that, and it was interesting to see a couple of them takes where they had the camera, the behind-the-scenes camera rolling while they were shooting without the CG tentacles and stuff. Yeah. And especially for people who aren't into production, I think that kind of thing is really eye-opening because you get to see just... But, you know, you really can't get a feel for how awkward that is until you're there. I mean, shooting that kind of stuff myself, even as the director, asking an actor to do that, okay, you're going to, like, do this really weird, jumpy, dodgy thing, and you're gonna, like, make some weird faces. I mean, this isn't my direction to them, of course, but it's an incredibly strange thing to shoot, and I think that that clip showcased that well.
And I think the entire setup, because maybe I just haven't seen the episode in a while, does create a real sense of danger. Because, like, yeah, I know Archer and Trip are going to survive. But the other, I think three other crewmen, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever, like, I didn't know if they made it. I thought, like, maybe one was going to die, and that was kind of going to be like, oh, we better hurry up or what. So that whole, and, you know, having them at different angles, they're not just, like, hanging vertically. They, you know, some are horizontal, yeah. some are whatever, does kind of create that whole... And then the stuff's always moving. I think that was the best thing, because it wasn't CGI. There was always, like, one tendril moving on an actor right. when you were talking.
And Enterprise, I think something they did really well was they did a good job of making the crew not expendable. Like, I remember, I think it was the first episode with the Borg. I don't think it was the best of both worlds.
Q-Who?
Yeah, it was Q-Who. And the Borg attacked. They attacked in that one, right?
Yeah, they chased the Enterprise, yeah. Yeah.
Right, and Picard was like, we've lost 18 crewmen or something. Mm-hmm. And that was all you heard of it. And, you know, in those times when you have a ship with 1,000 people, I think from a writing standpoint, it's really easy to gloss over that. You know, your crewmen just become numbers. But when you only have 83 people on your ship, and... The fact that they never hardly ever killed off crewmen until season 3.
Right.
I thought that they did a really good job of making you care about those crewmen in Vox Sola, especially because they gave them a little bit more to do in the episode. A little more interest to the characters, I guess.
You knew their favorite movies.
Yeah.
Or just that they wanted to see the movie.
Right.
I love the movie thing, and also near the end when their life signs are fading, they're having this conversation, and I like the fact that they're talking about the movie. It's because it felt like us. Again, the characters felt more natural. Like, they're just talking about something to keep their spirits up, and it happens to be a movie, which is something we would do. And I can't see the characters in later Star Trek series on the timeline talking about things like that in that situation. They're going to be more like, oh gosh, we're caught up in this like alien web thing. God, you remember the last time this happened? How did we get out of it?
Yeah, right.
You know, it would be like another day on the job for them.
I wonder if part of that isn't like underdeveloping the future in the other installments, because one thing I think about when writing future things a lot is, from a writer's standpoint, what can I have these characters do or say that would be done in the future and not be dated? And mm-hmm. I think if you can establish that in your future timelines, it becomes a lot easier to do that. And I don't think they really ever did that in TNG or DS9 or Voyager. I mean, they occasionally, you know, Voyager had the movies in the holodeck. But if you give your crew a human backdrop of things that they do in that time, it becomes a lot easier to have those conversations. And Enterprise luckily had that from the outset because of the time they were in. But I think it's something they could have done in the other shows had they really tried to.
And if T'Pol had been in that situation, we could talk about the different kinds of teas choose might think to choose that night right. to drink.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question that I think that I wish these shows would address more. It's like, what is culture like on a planet like Vulcan? You know, and even what is culture like on Earth? We hardly ever get to see that. It's one of the things I do like about JJ's Star Trek movies anyway, is we get to see much more of Earth that we never do in any of the Star Trek movies or shows. So I think there's definitely room to explore that stuff.
It's all bar fights and three ways. That's what it Earth is like in JJ.
Hey, that was a good fight.
Yeah, they do it a little bit in the other series, but not to the same extent, right? I mean, we have poker games in TNG.
Right.
We have, you know, hanging out in Quarks and playing darts and building models of the Alamo and things on DS9, but it's not the...
But I mean, that's all kind of like, I don't know, I feel like that's stuff that is pretty standard to just a random activity. And, you know, I don't know, it's not something that is culturally significant like watching movies, mm-hmm. like going to the theater. Playing darts or whatever, like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it has that cultural importance that movies traditionally do.
Right. Well, and even with the water polo in here, you know, this wasn't just a right. random water polo game. These were the finals for that year between Stanford and Texas. What's that?
It's no Parisi's Squares final. No, that's the sport.
But it's the thing, like, so I'm a college football fan, and of course I follow my team, which is the Alabama Crimson Tide, but I follow all of college football because I just love the sport, and I follow it year round. So of course, when it's in season, yes, I'm all over it. But even in the off season, like right now, I mean, I'm still every week I listen to podcasts about college football and I follow the news. And so that's something where you could see it's culturally significant for Archer as well. That, like, this is something that he really follows. He's really into, he's cut off from it right now. And Tripp actually has it straight out of the subspace mailbag, fresh out of the subspace mailbag for Archer.
And I do love the movie reference because I looked it up. I don't know if y'all, maybe everyone knows this one but me. It's called Wages of Fear. It's a French movie. 1953 is when it was made. And so I do love that, like, every Star Trek series, they have full knowledge of 200 to 300 years ago. Of course. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, why do they never do movies from 2000 or something? It's always like the 50s.
They would be like, what's the movie tonight? Well, it's Smurfs 2. Oh, is that the one with the blue guys? The one from Andorian? No, they're not Andorians. They're these little guys that live in mushrooms. Ooh, sounds groovy.
You'll love it. We're doing Michael Bay week.
I wonder if they've seen Galaxy Quest. They might find a certain familiarity with that.
Yes.
Well, I do love the joy of communal movie viewing, right? Because it's right. Like, oh, it's in the library. You can watch it anytime. No, it's not the same as watching a movie with other people.
Well, I mean, that goes back to the whole cultural significance of going to the theater with your friends or your family or whatever to see a movie, you know, especially back in the 50s and stuff. That was a big deal. That was a big entertainment thing. And, I mean, it even still is today. I mean, people can get movies anywhere, but we still like to go to the theater and see them. With other people.
I think Voyager made the reference, it's always bad when I try to do the episode title, Future Tense, basically where they went back to the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And
Future's End.
Future's End, sorry. Yeah, and Kes is like, you know, there's something to be said for the passive medium instead of being part of the story in the holodeck. And right. So, you know, they do group holodeck activities.
And
Neelix
is riveted by soap operas.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I loved that.
They're his stories.
Well, one other thing I wanted to touch on while we're talking about the early days of them being out in space and also the alien here is that this episode, it highlights how what we see is Roddenberry's vision and the principle of seeking out new life and trying to understand that life and respecting that life is something that hasn't really taken shape yet in Enterprise. And Phlox really carries the banner for this here. When Reed wants to torture the tentacle that they have in sickbay to find out what he would need to do to kill or at least make this alien back off so he can get the captain back. And Phlox is like, I can't let you do that. That's not something I can let you do. He says, tell me if I'm wrong, but isn't our mission to try to better understand unique forms of life? And Reed says, not if they're trying to kill the captain.
No, I kind of saw that as his Hippocratic oath more than Roddenberry's vision.
No, I mean, it represents Roddenberry's vision, though. It's so Phlox Denobulans they're very familiar with interacting with alien races. So I think it's not just the Hippocratic oath there, although you're right about that. I think it's also that Denobulans have a more evolved understanding of unique life forms than the humans do at this point. So he's representing what Star Trek will become for us in the 23rd, 24th century, whereas the humans right now are more like us. Like, this thing doesn't look like a life form to us, so I'll just do whatever I want to it.
And it's the moral question that we always ask ourselves, but there is no real good answer to. You know, do we save the crew or do we kill the creature? Mm-hmm. You know, what do the ends justify the means? In certain situations. And I think the interesting thing is every time I watch that episode or other shows or episodes or that same kind of question, I'm asking myself the question, I don't know what I would do. Which I think is one of the points of the show to get you thinking about it. And it's, I don't know, what would you guys do in that situation? Would you do what you had to do to take care of the creature and save the crew? Or try to find another way and maybe wait too long?
I think one of the challenges I had here was that I feel like T'Pol went too easily with killing it. Because I feel like if this had been any other episode, you might have the more emotional Trip saying taking that role. But it's kind of like, okay, well, we got Archer and Trip stuck up there. Reed's already saying explode everything. So who needs to? And Hoshi's like, no, we need to take the let's communicate. So T'Pol, you know, is like, well, let's. I think we should go with Reed. But I'm like, couldn't we have done both? Like, she's like, no, we're going to go. I'm like, couldn't you have said, hey, Hoshi, you work on communicating. Hey, Reed, you work on that. And then, well, so I just thought T'Pol gave in a little too easily. Because she should be the one saying, hey, alien life is different and we shouldn't see it through blinders.
Yeah.
Logically speaking, though, I think it's the answer that makes sense in that situation. Yeah. Because when you consider all the variables and the information you have, your first priority is to protect your crew. And at that point, they didn't really have any data that suggested it was an intelligent or sentient creature, which would make it, quote unquote, more valuable or as valuable as the crew. And so when your priority is your crew, I think that would be the logical choice.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think it shows the difference between Denobulans and Vulcans as the two alien voices as well, that Vulcans are going to follow that logical path that you just described, whereas Denobulans aren't bound by that logic.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were probably some signs at that point in the episode, but it does remind me of kind of military concerns of where you will have, as you know, having done it, having your military mission, that you have a mission, whether it's to, you know, do something hostile, you know, blow this up, take this hill, whatever, or even something more traditional that we do nowadays, you know, protect this village, you know, build this water project, whatever. You're always going to be exposing your folks to security concerns. And if your overriding concern is protect our people, well, then you've already blown your mission, because that's already, you know, if that's what's your priority, you know. And so I think here that certainly, as you can say, maybe it helps start to wrestle, what's your priority? Is our priority always to be safe? Well, if you don't always be safe, stay home at Earth. You'll be safe over there. But if it's to explore and strange new worlds and all that, then you're going to be in danger, as Q would say.
You'll be safe there until the Zindi come.
Right. And then I guess that would be that. I mean, that's sort of, isn't that with Terra Nova and all that, you know, hey, there's dangerous aliens, we need to stay home.
Earth, yeah, that first comes as a result of the whole Zindi scare. Yeah, it fuels that. Well, we are coming up on an hour, so let's wrap up here with final thoughts on the episode and our ratings. So, Suzanne, what are your final thoughts on Vox Sola?
Final thoughts? Overall, it was a really good episode. Showed a lot of growth from Hoshi to Paul. The goo really creeped me out. I could have done without that. And the snail trail left by the alien. Yeah. Nasty. No.
And the sound of the goo, too, is really nasty, too, right? Yeah. It's just like, ugh.
Yeah. Just having you think of an actor going through that. Ugh, no. Just goo. No.
I feel your pain if it makes you feel better.
Thank you.
What's your rating for the episode?
My rating would be 4 out of 5 slabs of prime rib with real horseradish.
Oh, excellent. Yes, you need the real horseradish.
Yes.
Philip, what are your final thoughts?
Now, did you feel her pain because y'all are connected? Or...
Yes.
Okay. I just want to double check. I think this is a, I mean, I think there's some better ones, but I think this is a good solid, season 1 Enterprise episode. Like you said, of what we talked about, you know, exploring strange new worlds, new aliens, that those frustrations. And I think there actually are a lot of character moments. You know, we talked about Hoshi, talked about Travis, Archer, Trip. I mean, I think everyone, for the most part, you know, Reed, we know what movies he likes, what tags he would have. you know, I think everyone kind of gets a chance to shine. So I think it's a good episode, and I would rate it 4 out of 8 assertive Travises.
Oh, very good. How about you, Tommy?
Well, I'm trying to think if there's something that hasn't been said yet in relation to the episode. I like how it's probably unintentional, but I like how it tied in a little bit later down the line in season 2 with the Cretaceans, mm-hmm, when they finally meet them again. But I like that everybody gets a little bit of character growth in this. You know, we get to see the side of Phlox where he's interested in protecting the life. And we haven't had too much of that from Phlox, except for it's Dear Doctor, right? Isn't that what it's called?
Yeah.
I am terrible with episode names.
You're talking about Dear Doctor, where there's the debate between Phlox and Archer about giving the cure.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And so everybody has a little bit to do in this, and then you get to see the side of Malcolm where he wants to take the assertive action of using the force, and Hoshi wants to communicate. And in that sense, I think it was very well written. Except for the fact, and you know, actually even Travis had something to do, because he got to talk to the aliens, and which would normally be Hoshi's job, and he got to figure out what they did. And
I like what he says, you speak English. The captain's like, yeah, we studied your database. It wasn't difficult.
Travis which is like, an interesting character point for them. They must be some pretty smart people. You know, they're really strange, but they must be pretty advanced.
Well, it was also kind of like saying, humans, you're still primitive. Your language was really easy to figure out.
Right, yeah. Which is very rude for people who are so interested in being non-offensive.
Yeah, Travis should have demanded an apology from them.
Yeah, I don't know, right? But that was, I think he was having that awkward phone call where you don't really know what to say, you know? And that I think that worked really well. But overall, I loved the episode a lot. I thought it was classic Star Trek and classic exploration. And I think nobody ever gives things 10 out of 10. I'm going to give it 10 out of 10 gold press Latinum bars.
Okay, ooh. Excellent. Well, I like one thing we didn't mention that I like is we get a little technology preview in here where we get to see a force field. It's the first time we've ever seen a force field on the timeline on a starship, a Starfleet vessel. And Malcolm talks about how Starfleet has been trying to create a stable force field for 5 years. And then he goes on and does it in 20 minutes. But I'm going to assume that they were like really close, you know, and he had all the specs in the computer and was able to figure it out. But what's more interesting about it is that this is the technology that will lead to shields on starships as well, because the NX-01 doesn't have shields.
And it's all thanks to Malcolm.
And so you've got the read alert, you've got read shields, you've got all kinds. I'm sure he wanted everything to be called read, and Starfleet said, look, you know, I don't think it's going to catch on here. So that was interesting, and we get to see the early Universal Translator, again, being developed. Things happen in this episode that will help to flesh out the UT. And I will have to say that whatever device, this proto-UT that Hoshi is using, it looks a lot like an old walkie-talkie I had when I was a kid, or like one of those scanning things they use in supermarkets to check inventory.
I was going to point that out, that that's very realistic. In this post-iPhone world, you know, everything has to be sleek. I'm like, when I was in the Army, a plugger was a GPS. Those things looked like exactly like that, big and bulky. Things are not nice and sleek in the real world, you know, in the real military and all that stuff. So I did like that kind of bulkiness.
Right, because you can't just run down. Like, if you're trying to talk to a plastic wrap alien and something's not working, you can't run down to the Genius Bar and have that fixed. That thing's got to be rugged. You've got to know it's going to work. So the technology previews in here were interesting. And also, you do know who played the Kritassan captain, don't you? I'm sure, Tommy, you do.
Admiral Forrest.
Yep. Which is actually the 12th character that Von Armstrong has played in Star Trek. It's amazing how they can transform him, especially because on this show, on Enterprise, he plays Admiral Forrest, a human. And then he could walk in and play this other easily offended alien. And
I had no idea. I'm not even kidding you. That never dawned on me.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's so good then, if you didn't know, because he really can transform himself. He's you never think about it, but he's almost like Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
Yeah.
Wait, didn't Von Armstrong also play the slimy demon, you know, creature too? Didn't he play that too?
I didn't recognize him, but yeah, maybe that was him as well.
He was a Klingon once, too. Did you mention that?
I didn't mention it here, but yeah, he has been a Klingon.
Yeah. I mean, he was a Klingon in Enterprise once, too. I don't know. Was he in the other shows, too?
Yes, he was in Code of Honor. First season, Next Generation. I'm blanking. Heart of Glory. There you go.
Yeah, he was Chorus in Heart of Glory. Now, on Enterprise, he was the Klingon captain in Sleeping Dogs.
Yeah, I remember the special feature on that. It was really interesting. He said he had to come in last minute to do that, and he had to learn all the Klingon, and it was really hard.
He was also, Suzanne, do you know which Voyager characters Von Armstrong played? I'll just tell you and tell me if you can recognize him now. He was Telek Ramor from Eye of the Needle.
No!
Yep.
No way! He was not! I love Telek Ramor.
He was also 2 of 9, the Borg in Survival Instinct.
Borg,
He's the Vidian captain in Fury. He's an Alpha Herogian in Flesh and Blood. He's Korath, the Klingon, in Endgame.
Did he substitute for Janeway at any point? Because he seemed to be everybody else.
I think he did play the role of Janeway in Workforce.
Good, it wasn't really her.
Why does he never get the credit that Jeffrey Combs does? I mean, Jeffrey Combs is great too, but I mean, I didn't even realize that Von Armstrong had done so much Star Trek.
I think it's just because Jeffrey Combs' roles are persistent roles.
That's true.
With Wayoon, with Shran, with Brunt, even.
They're very big.
You get to actually know the character really well over the course of time, especially with Shran and Wayoon. I think that's it, because otherwise, Von Armstrong, he's also everywhere.
Yeah.
He was also the whale probe in Star Trek IV, by the way.
Oh, that's right. Now, was he the front end or the back end? Because wasn't that like a little donkey?
I'm going to say the thing that comes out and
spins. Yeah, he was the little ball that came down.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And Jeffrey Combs was the beam of light that suspended the ball.
Right, of course.
I think for a lot of people, Jeffrey Combs is their own personal beam of light.
Okay, well, I'm going to give this episode 8 very, very sincere apologies.
Your rating is accepted.
All right. Thank you very much. Now tell me the coordinates. I need to know, Philip. All right. Well, Suzanne and Tommy, thanks for joining us today. Before we go, Suzanne, tell people where they can find you around the interwebs.
You can find me on the Twitter at Suzanne Abbott.
All right. Hard username to remember there.
Yeah.
And Tommy, tell people where they can find you. And also, congratulations, Star Trek Horizon is funded on Kickstarter. Very successful Kickstarter.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We went like 226% past our goal. So that was really cool.
Excellent.
You can find me on the Twitter as well. And that's at Tommy G Dog, and it's DAWGY, because I made that username when I was in like 8th grade, and it's just stuck. I use it for everything now. And for Star Trek Horizon, you can find it at StarTrekHorizon.com or on the Facebook, Facebook.com/STHorizon.
Definitely go check it out. It's really amazing what Tommy's doing. And if you're an Enterprise fan, you're definitely going to want to see Horizon when it comes out.
Well, thank you. It's very, very nice of you.
And also, Tommy, I'm glad that you did shorten your username, though, because I know when you were in 6th grade, it was Tommy G Doggy Dog.
Exactly. I don't know how you knew that, but you did.
I do my research, Tommy. I do my research.
Right, like all good reporters do.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today, guys.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Chris, it was great talking to Suzanne and Tommy about the evil slime monster in Vox Sola. And I think we all learned a life lesson about, you know what? It's not over until you think it's over in your heart. You got to keep on playing the game.
Well, I will point out, Philip, that the creature in this episode was really not evil. He was away from home and scared, and he wanted to have contact with other life forms, and he thought the best way to do that was to catch them in his web. And, you know, the title of this episode is Latin for lone voice, which actually fits very well the situation that the creature was in.
It does. It does. I almost thought that the lone voice would be, the movie we never saw for movie night. I mean, I'm still frustrated. When you promised I was going to get to see it, Chris.
I know, but the problem is that in the lone voice, nothing gets blown up. And so I had to change the plans because otherwise Malcolm was not going to come to the movie night.
Oh, well, unless you're going to do a song and dance for me, Chris, I think we need to move on.
Don't tempt me. We have the cameras on. Well, yeah, it was a lot of fun talking about this episode today, but it's not the only thing we've been discussing here on the network over the past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things we've been talking about on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Arena commentary.
They're like, everything is fine.
There's nothing. Just come down.
We have fried chicken. It's good.
Earl Grey.
Picard's romances.
You say it's not great, Philip, but what I think you mean is it's probably one of the most forgettable episodes of the entire series.
The Ready Room.
The Romulan War.
that was, what, the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th episode of the original series. Lawrence Schneider, he invents the Romulans. That was the whole genesis of it. And if they'd known that the Romulans might have been a recurring alien, they might not have given them those, you know, quote-unquote expensive helmets.
The orb.
We find out, and Quark finds out, as we're talking about how he reacts and sort of comes to terms with what his mother's doing. She's the woman behind the curtain. She's the person who is calling the shots at the highest level of Ferengi society.
To the journey!
Ultimate Season 5 Marathon.
You could argue brother and sister, but maybe more like your favorite uncle, who you once had a sex dream about. I don't know.
So that explains persistence of vision.
Yeah. Warp 5.
Archer's lost loves.
Not Dodge so much, it's just he's unsure of himself in that regard. He can be a starship captain, but a guy in love, I don't know about that.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
The TNG Companion.
He secretly doesn't know every time he replies to me on Twitter, I let out a little fan squeal on the other end. I play it cool, though. I play it cool, guys.
No, I'm the same exact way, but I don't play it cool.
By little fan squeal, you mean that sound Chekhov made in the last picture.
Continuing mission.
The continuing mission audio drama.
Our writer, David Rains, is a huge Lovecraft fan. And all of these Lovecraftian creatures are from outer space. And, you know, the Star Trek characters, they're always running into, you know, these godlike beings, but, you know, they're not benevolent, but, you know, they speak English, and, you know, they look like William Campbell. And
literary treks.
Serpents among the ruins.
We'll always help Paris.
Wow, you just destroyed one of my favorite lines from my favorite movie ever.
We'll always have Iron Mike Paris.
Oh, God. All right.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find them pretty much everywhere you get your podcasts. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, a Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. We're also on Swell, which is like the Pandora of podcasts. And we're even on BlackBerry. Some people out there are listening to podcasts on BlackBerry. You can also go to our website and stream the episode from the show page if you like, or you can get the RSS feed and drop that into your favorite podcatcher. And if iTunes is your choice of venue for podcast consumption, be sure to check out our artist page where we have lots of our past content grouped into different sections there. And you can find some of the past discussions and interviews. We have almost 1,000 episodes for you now, so there's a lot of great content that has gotten buried over the years. You can easily get there by just going to itunes.com/trekfm. And if you enjoy the show, please take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. We'd love to hear from you, and it does help other Star Trek fans find the show. You can also leave reviews now on Stitcher, I believe. They have just introduced that over the past few weeks. Also, another thing that we've introduced recently is the Trek.fm Complete Master Feed. And that actually gives you every episode of every one of our shows and some extra content that we're going to be putting in there that's not in the individual show feeds. So if you want a great way to sample other shows that you don't listen to right now, or if you're one of the listeners we have who amazingly listens to everything that we produce, and there are some of those listeners out there, and we love you very, very much. Thank you for doing that. You can get all that in one place through the Complete Master Feed as well. And you can find that in most places now. iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Swell. Check it out. You'll find it there. Well, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's episode on Vox Sola or anything we talked about in news, there are a number of ways to do that as well. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that will come to us by email. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. On Google Plus, just search communities for Trek.fm and you'll find our community. And we also have traditional forums on our website at Trek.fm/forums. Now, Philip, when you're not, you know, trying to figure out just how much EM radiation a tentacle can take, where can people find you?
Well, they can find me on Twitter. My handle there is NC Public Servant, NC like North Carolina. And they can catch me each and every week, either on the master feed of Trek FM or
alone on Trek FM's Earl Grey, our dedicated TNG show, along with Messrs. Daniel Prue and Darren Moser, as we talk all things The Next Generation each and every week.
Excellent.
And Chris, when someone needs to cheer you up, where can they find you on the internet?
Well, yeah, you know, I sometimes get depressed because Robin Loeffler was only in two episodes of TNG. So, you know, if you want to help cheer me up, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username and on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And elsewhere on the network, you can find me with Matthew Rushing on Literary Treks, where we talk Star Trek books and comics. Matthew and I also do The Orb together, where we talk all things Deep Space Nine. There's Warp 5, which is all about Enterprise, so if you enjoyed today's show, you'll definitely want to check out Warp 5, the most recent episode that I just put out. I'm joined by Crystal Allen, who is the actress that played Dinesh, the Orion slave girl, in the episode Bound. And we talked about how she got the role, what it was like being on the set, and other things as well, not even related to Star Trek. And that's an interesting little chat there, so you can check that out. Also, Continuing Mission, which we've mentioned many times today, which is about Star Trek fan films. So I'm on a lot of shows. I'm kind of like, I guess, the Von Armstrong of Star Trek podcasters, if I want to pick up a cue from today's show. So check those out as well. Before we let you go, we'd also like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks online. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. So pick up Diane Duane's Dark Mirror or anything else you like and give it a try. If you decide not to stick with Audible, you get to keep that book, so there's nothing to lose, but you're going to love Audible. And by supporting Audible, you're helping us keep the Ready Room coming to you every week. And we really thank Audible for their support of the network as well. Again, the way you do that is to go to audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, Philip, it's almost lunchtime here, and I'm getting very hungry. I'm going to wander back down to Archer's quarters and see if there are any pretzels left, because I'm pretty sure that Archer and Tripp cannot possibly eat that many pretzels by themselves.
Well, if you get thirsty, I think there's a thimble of beer left. But I think it's time to stick a forced apology in it, because the Ready Room is done.